You get to ask all sorts of questions that nobody else is really allowed to ask about the business, about how they're running, about what decisions they're making. So it is quite interesting. I think you get a lot of insight. So definitely I don't see it as that horrible, boring thing that I think a lot of people do have that view.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Lindsay Weber from OmniPro. Now, I have interviewed, let's say, almost 150, 180 CFOs, fractional CFOs on the podcast so far. And a common theme is that they start off in audit and swiftly move on. You know, they get their credentials with KPMG and then they move on to something else. However, audit might not be interesting to everyone until it is. When you need an audit or if something goes wrong, suddenly audits become very important indeed. And in fact, for many of our customers at Procurement Express, audits are a vital part of their survival as an organization. Being able to demonstrate how funds have been used is often key to their continued existence. And a lot of times, whether they're NGO or they have government funding or a range of other sources, or in fact, for reputational reasons, it's very important to be able to demonstrate, not just say that you are handling funds in the way that you said you would. So for that purpose, I've invited Lindsay onto the podcast. We are going to discuss, you know, her background as well as the modern audit, what's changing in the market, what people need to be aware of, and how you can be successful in your for your clients when it comes to making sure that they are compliant. So let's kick things off. Lindsay, maybe you can kick us off by telling us something about you that not many people know.
Perfect. Thanks, James. Yeah, so one of the things about me that not a lot of people know, and it's my one good story, is that I was nearly in a movie. When I was about 19 or 20, I was at home in the university holidays, and my parents owned a hardware shop in a very small town in South Africa. And I was working in the hardware shop. And it was a cold winter's morning. And I mean, it's a hardware shop. It's a big open building. So there's no heating. And it was freezing. So it was all wrapped up. No makeup, looked like a sight. And I saw it was very quiet. So we were standing and looking at out the window. And we saw a camera crew rock up. And they went into the shop next door. And we sort of wondered what was going on. There was at least two cameramen with cameras and guys with the big sound booms. And they walked into the shop next door. We thought, what's going on here? It's not like very much happens in my little town. And then they walked out a few minutes later and they walked into our shop. And we were like, whoa, what's going on now? And then this very short man said to us, hi, his name is Paulie Shaw, in this very, very Yankee accent. And we had no idea who Paulie Shaw was, but he was quite offended that we didn't know who he was. And he said he was there to adopt an African baby. It was around the time that Madonna and all the celebrities were going and adopting little African babies. And he wanted to know, could we point him in the right direction where he could find an African baby? And my mom is quite quick. And she very, without batting an eyelid, she said, this is Lindsay. Would you like to adopt her? I was mortified. And then she started listing my good qualities, one of which was that I'm fully potty trained. I was mortified. Anyway, Paulie Shaw obviously found this quite amusing.
At 19 years old.
19 years old, I was fully potty trained. That was my number one selling criteria.
Mothers, you got to love them, huh? They'll cut you down to size no matter what
Anytime.
You do. Yeah. I also spent a lot of time in a rural town in South Africa. My wife is South African, and, you know, the hardware stores were kind of was a hub of the community, in a way, in a rural area, not like whatever in the cities where everyone wanders in and buys their stuff and heads off. But it was like that for your store, where you kind of like the equivalent of an Irish pub in a local town in South Africa where people used to hang out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my parents are very much part of the community there, and they would have heard all the gossip that went through the shop, and they were very much in touch with what's going on. And, you know, as soon as somebody new moves into the area, one of the first things that they need to do is fix the bits of the house that, you know,
right.
So the hardware shop is quite often the first place that the people go to when they're new to the area. And it's the first place when they're asking around, well, how do I find a plumber? How do I get an electrician? You know, the hardware shop would have been one of the first places. So it was very much a hub of the community for sure.
And the finance function and the entrepreneur is often the sort of yin and yang in any business. And so were you not tempted to become an entrepreneur yourself, or maybe you have a little bit now in what your current role, or did it put you off running a business, seeing your parents, what they had to go through to keep things afloat?
Yeah, I think it almost put me off a little bit. You know, the risk that you have to take and the amount of work that you have to do. The hardware shop was open every day a year, except 4 days a year. 4 days a year it was closed. Every other day it was open. And in most cases, one of my parents was in there, or both of them were in there running the show. So it's a lot of work, and I have a lot of respect for entrepreneurs. I don't have the entrepreneurial drive myself. I just don't like taking that much risk. But I do think it's really interesting. And I mean, I've often thought about it, but I've never taken the leap.
Yeah, well, that's good. I don't need the competition, to be honest. You stay what you're doing. I'm very happy with that. So, okay, well, listen, not everybody gets onto the Gross Profit Podcast. You must be pretty hot stuff to get this far. And I know you have a lot of experience behind you, but maybe you could bring us back to the beginning and just explain the arc of your career and how you've ended up training hundreds of accountants and auditors today. So, yeah, tell us, how did you get started?
Sure. So I would have qualified as a South African chartered accountant. And in order to do that, we have to do a South African chartered accountancy degree or a degree in accounting. So I did that. And then I trained with KPMG in Johannesburg. I specialized in the audit of financial services companies, so banks and property companies. While I was there, I was lucky enough to be part of what we had, the KPMG Academy. I don't think it's running anymore. But at the time, there was a huge shortage of graduates coming through from the universities. So KPMG put into place the KPMG Academy, where we supported students who had attempted their sort of fourth year, attempted their degree, hadn't quite made it, and were doing it part-time while they worked for KPMG. So I was lucky enough to be part of that. And I also did some training with KPMG, where I was the trainer for some of the younger graduates towards the end of my training contract. When I was looking for something to do after my training contract, I decided I didn't want to stay in audit. So I went back to my university and I lectured audit instead. So I'm not sure if that was a good decision or not, but I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the interaction with the students and the educational side of it and the academic side of that. So I did that for about 7 years before I decided to move over to Ireland. I joined a small firm in the Dublin city centre for a year just to get some Irish experience, and then moved on to a larger firm. I was audit manager there for about 3 years before I moved to OmniPro, and I've been at OmniPro 4 years now. I can't believe it's gone so fast. And yeah, my job, my role at OmniPro is very much working with other accountants. I do a lot of CPD webinars. I do a lot of sort of technical queries when accountants have this client with this problem, how do we account for it? How do we audit this? I answer those sort of queries as well, which I find really interesting because I'm not dealing with the sort of day-to-day accounting issues. I'm dealing with the tricky bits, and I like that. It's always interesting and it's always challenging, and we get in some bizarre questions.
Very good. Okay, well, I'm going to have to put a pin in that and ask about some of the most bizarre questions you've had. But I do want to touch on, I mean, you had an unusual success early on in Rhodes, which is a beautiful university. Yeah. I've been to the Rose Town. It's beautiful in Grahamstown, right?
Yeah.
And I've been there for the Arts Festival every year, which is a big highlight. And it's very nice if you get a chance to go there. But you hit the highlight. You were hired as a lecturer at an early age. At the age of what did you become a lecturer already?
Then? 24. I was appointed a senior lecturer. Yeah. So that was really great. I studied at Rhodes and I always thought, oh, wouldn't it be nice to come back one day when I'm old and lecture? And it happened a lot faster than I thought it would. So when I finished my training contract, I found there was a vacancy there and I applied for it. And I had this panel interview. There were five or six people and there was the dean and all of the old professors that had lectured me. And it was very intimidating. But fortunately, they decided I was the one and they appointed me a senior lecturer there. So I really enjoyed it. It was a really great 7 years there.
Wow. So you're probably maybe a few years younger than some of your students in a lot of cases. It must have been, was that ever a problem? Did you have a problem establishing your authority or expertise, or did it not matter? Were you down there in Freshers Week with everyone else, even when you were a lecturer?
I think I did have to work slightly harder just to establish my sort of credibility, but I also managed to connect a lot easier with my students. So there was kind of both to it. Mm. But I think once the students realized that, you know, I was fair and not as boring as maybe some of the other auditing lecturers, which is auditing is not the most exciting subject. And I did try to make it, you know, as interesting and as achievable as possible. And accessible as possible as well. So I think it maybe took me a little bit of extra work to establish that, but I think being younger did help me to connect a little bit better with the students, understand where they were coming from, and, you know, connect with them on sort of an interpersonal level as well.
One of my favorite questions to ask interviewees for roles is, you know, give me an example of unusual success you've had in your career. And I would categorize that, you know, being promoted so early, so quickly. Does that give you confidence, you know, maybe a few years later, are you able to look back at that and go, well, if those people believed in me at that stage, well, then maybe I'm able to do other things as well. Like, is it a source of inspiration to you that, you know, it was a validation to get something like that so early in your career, I guess?
Yeah, and I think it's given me the confidence to do the things that I've done since, you know. So even when I started lecturing at Rhodes, it was still quite scary because suddenly you're faced with, you know, 80 students looking at you first thing on a Monday morning, not really interested in what you're trying to say. And you have to kind of get through it. You have to make it interesting. You have to try and connect. And I think in doing that and in building that sort of skill, it's really given me a lot of confidence to do other things. And, you know, it builds and builds. So I think that really helped, yeah.
Okay. So can I ask about, because, you know, it comes up all the time. People do audit for a year or two and then they move on. And, you know, are there lifers out there? Are there people who are just built for it?
Oh,
and this is what they've meant to put on this earth for?
Yeah, I think there really are. At Omnipro, we work with a lot of sort of smaller auditors. So, you know, maybe one man operations or smaller, you know, 10 or 15 people teams. And there's definitely, we can see, you know, of the clients who are really, you know, interested in audit and who are, you know, doing this because really they do find it very interesting. And I think there's a lot to be said for audit. You learn a lot from your clients and you have quite a more wide range of what you see every day. So I think there's a lot to be said for it. It can be very interesting. You work with a lot of different people. You're always seeing different businesses and you're getting an inside of you into all the different businesses. You get to ask all sorts of questions that nobody else is really allowed to ask about the business, about how they're running, about what their decisions they're making. So it is quite interesting. I think you get a lot of insight. So definitely I don't see it as that horrible, boring thing that I think a lot of people do have that view.
Yeah. So what would you say are the character attributes of someone who really is suited to audit? Are they, you know, well, are they fastidious? Are they, you know, curious? Are they nosy? Are they, how would you describe, like, what would you say? How would you know, maybe I should look into doing more audit? Maybe I'm suited to it.
I think it's going to be somebody who's quite critical because you do need to look at everything with quite a critical lens. You've got to be constantly asking questions, is this true? Is this valid? Is this complete? So it is somebody who's quite critical in their approach, but also somebody who is genuinely curious about business and about how businesses work and how they can help their clients. You know, there's a lot that we can do as auditors to help our clients. So yeah, somebody who's interested and curious about business, but also has that sort of critical lens and can look very critically at a situation, at what they're being told, and really think, does this make sense? Is it valid? Is it true? And then you do need to have very good attention to detail. So it is about looking at the detail of the accounts. Do they make sense? Are they meeting all of the requirements of all of the legislation that we've got to think about as well?
Yeah. Well, this is, maybe we'll touch on this a little bit. You talk about legislation because this is the intersection between the numbers, do things add up, and the compliance, I guess, what the law says in some cases. And then there's this, I guess there's a good amount of interpretation. So you need a set of skills around, you know, kind of a lawyer's mind in a certain way, do you? And then combine that with the, like, know how the accounts work in and out on a detail level.
Yeah, so you've got to have a really good understanding of your clients. You've got to have an understanding of the laws and regulations that apply to your clients, but you've also got to have an understanding of sort of the Companies Act requirements, all of the audit requirements. You know, there's international audit standards and all of our audits are done under those. And then you've also got to understand the financial reporting side of it. So what are the financial reporting requirements, making sure that those are all complied with as well. So there is a lot of compliance work, and that's just with audit. You know, if we think about all the compliance that accountants have to deal with in tax and, you know, payroll, those sort of things as well. There's a huge amount of compliance work that has to be done. Anti-money laundering, huge amount of compliance work. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess if you need an audit, you already know it, but maybe we should step back and just consider, like, what are the buckets, big buckets of people who generally need, you know, audits? I guess no one gets one for fun. So maybe unless you, although in fairness, we've had one for the last 10 years, as, you know, voluntarily, if you like, for the last five for sure. And it kind of gave us a sense of confidence, even though we're, you know, we didn't really have anyone to report to. Up until last year, which we'll discuss later on, we got one because it gave us this sense of, okay, a double check on everything and the bookkeeper and everything up and down. It gave us that sort of peace of mind, kind of insurance, I guess. But who, other than that, like, who just needs one, full stop, no choice, don't, do not pass go, you got to get an audit?
I'd say this, mostly for companies, it depends on size. So there are regulations around the different sizes of companies and who needs an audit and who doesn't. So for companies, it's mostly around size, but then there are different requirements. And there are other reasons that you might get an audit as well. But things like charities, a lot of charities will need an audit, and they might get that because of the size, but they might get that because of funding requirements. So a lot of the big funders require charities to have an audit. A lot of the sort of regulated entities, things like insurance brokers, mortgage brokers, those type of entities require an audit, even though they might be very small, just because they're more regulated. So there are kind of a number of reasons. A lot of companies do like to get an audit because it does give them that peace of mind, and it gives them a little bit more leverage as well if they're applying for funding. Quite often small companies, when they're applying for funding, will get an audit so that they can give a little bit more. It builds a bit of more credibility when they're going out applying for funding. And often, you know, a startup funder will require an audit as well to make sure that their funds are safe and are being appropriately dealt with.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I hadn't actually thought of that, but you're dead right. So for funding requirements, a lot of banks just will require it, or they'll give you a better rate the more assurance you can give them. And this is part of that. So that makes a ton of sense. And then certain industries, I guess, you know, just need it as part of it. I guess it all comes down to where we see it most is where it's funded, the money, there's a certain amount of external funding, whether it be investor funding or from a regulatory body or from a government body, you know, they just want that when they're hands off, they want that assurance everything has been going, is going well. Yeah. So you referenced it, so I'm going to ask about it. The strange requests that you get brought in on, like when you say strange requests, what are the sort of the quandaries that auditors face that they bring to you when they're not sure where to go?
I think one of the weirdest ones we got was about fish. It was somebody who was auditing a fish farm and all of the fish had died. They'd gotten some sort of fish disease and they died after year end. And the accountant in question, or the auditor, had asked, how do we deal with these dead fish? How do we account for them? Now, from an accounting perspective, it was a really easy answer, right? It's post-balance sheet events. You just disclose it in the accounts. But it was just such an odd question because I don't know anything about fish farming. And I got this question and it was in December and I was up the walls and I quickly read it. And I was like, I don't know. I don't know how you account for dead fish. How am I supposed to know how to account for dead fish? But yeah, we do get some weird ones. I also got a weird one about a company that is developing a plot of land that will be a cemetery, and they're selling the burial plots, but they're also building a visitor center. And how do we account for the sale of the burial plots? Because they're sort of pre-selling the burial plots, but you can't use them until the visitor center is complete and the park or the cemetery is open. But it's kind of a weird one. How do you pre-sell a burial plot and how do you account for that? So yeah, it's those sort of odd businesses that do have weird accounting questions, and it's always interesting and a bit challenging there.
Okay, so it's sort of, what would you say, deferred income, that you technically they'd be insolvent if they use that money, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, so it's deferred income because they haven't essentially delivered the burial plot, because nobody can use that burial plot. Once they actually open the cemetery and somebody can use the burial plot, then they can recognize the revenue. But until then, they'd have to recognize it as deferred income because they can't deliver the goods.
I mean, that's a great thing for cash flow, amazing business that can do that. But if you haven't earned the money, by accounting principles, tell me if I'm wrong here, you don't own it yet. You can't really use it for anything. You're supposed to just have it off to the size. I don't know. We have this issue with our business as well, where we, you know, we pre-sell licenses.
Okay, yeah.
And we have this deferred income account, which we totally ignore, and we just use it the way we want to, pretty much. But in theory, you know, everyone, all the customers might come back and say, hey, we want our money back. We've changed our mind. I guess that can't really happen for a burial situation. So how did you handle it in the end? I mean, are they insolvent if they use that money to develop the visitor center, or?
No, so insolvency is different from the financial reporting requirements, and it really looks at the cash flow. So they can use that cash for whatever they want. As long as they deliver the burial plots, there's no problem. Ryanair would be famous for this. You know, any airline, they pre-sell all of those tickets. And at year end, they have a load of tickets booked. They've got to still issue those flights, but Ryanair can do whatever they want with that money in the meantime.
So let's talk a little bit about liability. I was discussing recently with, you know, an auditor with the federal government, actually, in the US, and they had a bit of a gripe with private auditors. And it was that when you hire a private auditing firm, you know, in the letter of engagement, they disclaim themselves from all liability. And yet, you know, their job is to make sure you're not liable for anything. So there's this, and sometimes there's comeback. So when you have clients who are, you know, who are working with people, and then the, you know, people aren't happy with the output of their audit, how can accountancy firms guard themselves against that? Or what sort of route, you know, can they be brought to any sort of association if there's complaints against them? And how do they defend against those complaints where it may happen? Because by the nature of an audit, if you hire, it's this weird situation where I'm paying someone to come and try and find problems in my business. And if they find them, then I'm mad at them, obviously, and I'm paying them. Yeah. So there's a weird, the stars aren't aligned there. There's a weird sort of dynamic there where I'm paying you and yet you're criticizing me and you're potentially causing me a lot of trouble. Because there are reporting requirements, I guess, if you find something in an audit, or maybe not. So how do is this an issue for people who are carrying out audits, and how would you advise them if that situation arises?
It's fortunately not something we see too much of, but it can happen where you get a disgruntled client and they can report you to the institute is typically where they would go. So to whichever body is regulating that particular auditor, if it's Chartered Accountants Ireland or ACCA or Chartered Accountants of England and Wales. Fortunately, we don't see it too often, but inevitably it's going to come down to did the auditor act in line with the various pieces of legislation and regulation. So it's going to come down to did the auditor act within the remit of the auditing standards. And a lot of what we do on audits is making sure that we've documented everything we've done on our audit file. And if you've got your audit file, you've got all the evidence that shows exactly what you've done, why you've made the decisions you've made, and why you've concluded in those ways. There's not too much that really can come back onto the auditor. The institute will do an investigation. They'll probably ask to see the audit file or at least certain parts of it. And you'd have to give that to the auditor, to the institute. And then they'll do their investigation. They'll look at it. They will decide, have you got enough audit evidence? Have you documented this appropriately? And conclude on that. Generally, the institutes do find on behalf of the auditors, they do find that the auditors have done the job appropriately, which I think is more of a reflection on the auditors than on the institutes necessarily, because the institutes are there to make sure that we are doing the things correctly. And I think in general, auditors are, we've got the right evidence, we've made the right decisions. And it does happen that sometimes it's not even a disgruntled client, it can be a third party that's just brought in a claim against the auditors for reasons, you know, they can be varied. They can just be trying to create more chaos sometimes. I do think they're just complaining people. But, you know, it's quite stressful for auditors and accountants to go through that process. It is a question on their integrity. And the institutes do look very closely at that. They do institute disciplinary procedures of that. And the accountants has got to defend themselves. They've got to respond. They've got deadlines to meet those responses. So it can be very stressful. And often it is, you know, nothing to do with the auditors, or, you know, the auditors haven't done anything wrong, they still find themselves in that position where they have to defend what they're doing. And it can happen on any client. You know, there's not always a clear reason or something that the auditor was able to see this coming down the line. It just comes out of the blue in most cases.
And this brings me on a little bit to government and governance, I guess, particularly how governments are using audits more generally. And when it comes to labeling, especially when it comes to something like ESG, which has been brought into the audit discussion. And my own personal view is that, you know, through audits and accountants, the government is seeking to affect societal change. They've figured out, hold on, we've got to try and save the planet here. And who knew? The accountants are the heroes of the piece. They're going to come and, well, whether they like it or not, have a say now in trying to do this. So what's your take on, you know, are governments overstepping, if you like, in trying to enforce these, you know, which are arguably societal goals, you know, but they're trying to enforce it through business and through audits? Do you think that's right or wrong, or it's a fair burden to put on the accountancy firms? And what's your personal view?
Yeah,
there?
It is a tricky one. And I think certainly the first level of EU regulation that came in, was it 2 or 3 years ago, was very onerous on businesses and on accountants. And we've seen the first tranche of that reporting come through earlier this year, only for those very largest of companies. There's been so much pushback on that the EU has rolled back on those requirements, and they've deferred everything for 2 years, and they are looking at simplifying those requirements because they were very onerous. I mean, climate change is a big problem, and I think everybody has to take some accountability for what we need to do. But I do think there's a kind of an unfair burden being put on businesses and on accountants without sufficient support. So there is maybe perhaps not enough support in meeting these goals, in giving enough time for everybody to get to grips with what's going to be required, how we're going to assure these different disclosures, because it's new and it's different and we don't know what's going on. And having this regulation that you have to do this now, it's just putting everybody off, and everybody's kind of panicking and nobody really understands what's going on. So I do think that I want to say that everybody needs to be doing their bit. I think there needs to be a lot more support and perhaps a more gradual phased requirements for these. And I do think that companies need to understand their impact on the environment, and they should be reporting on that. But it needs to be done in a measured way and in given enough support to enable companies to do that. Because at the moment, I don't know how a company, especially a small company, can measure their impact. If I tried as an individual to measure my impact, I wouldn't have any idea where to start. So we need to know, how do we start? How do we measure our impact? You know, what are the things that we need to look at? What are the things we need to report? And it needs to be very clear, understandable, reasonable reporting requirements. The first EU reporting requirements were over 1,000 data points that companies had to consider. They didn't have to report on all of them, but they had to consider them. That's an enormous burden to put on already busy, overstretched companies and reporting teams. So I think that's hugely ambitious and overly onerous. Mm. But I do think we've got to find a middle line somewhere where we are all aware, a little bit more aware of what impact we do have on the environment and how we can minimize that. But there needs to be sufficient support, and we need to be given sufficient time to implement those kind of changes.
Yeah. So coming on to your work in OmniPro, you do a lot of CPD work. Yeah. Where's there most demand? Like where do you support accountancy firms or auditing firms most today?
So we find that tax webinars are very popular. So we do webinars 3 times a week, both in Ireland and the UK, and almost half of those webinars are tax related. Tax is hugely popular. I think it's because it is so complex and there's so many regulations and it changes so frequently. It's really difficult to keep up. So we have a lot of tax. We also have webinars on financial reporting, auditing, anti-money laundering, companies law. We also do sort of more softer skills as well, personal development, practice development as well, marketing, that kind of side of it as well.
And who is the sort of ideal customer for you in terms of who should, if you're listening to this, who should reach out to you if they need help in it? I mean, CBD points, everyone has to get, so you need some points. It's a good starting point, but who, anyone else who's a common customer for you?
So most of our clients are sort of small to medium-sized accounting firms or accountants in small to medium-sized firms, mostly in practice, although we do have webinars specifically for industry accountants as well, but it's mostly for in-practice accountants. And we've got lots and lots of webinars. They're available kind of on demand as well. So if anybody's looking for particular CPD points or CPD in a particular area, they can go on to CPD Store is our product, CPD Store. We have UK or .ie, and you can have a look at for the webinar that suits you. So if you're looking at a particular type of tax issue, you can search for that, find the webinar that will give you the answers that you need to help the client that you're dealing with at the moment.
Can I ask there, you mentioned most of your clients are in practice, but the private people who are in, how would you describe it? People who are in industry or who are people who are in the belly of the beast, as I call it, in a business somewhere. So how do their needs differ? Because I guess they're not so interested in tax. Or are they? Tell me where I'm wrong.
Yeah, their needs will be slightly different. We have fewer of those, not because they have different requirements for CPD so much, as they don't get audited for CPD so much. So I think there's less pressure on the accountants in industry to get their CPD and keep it up to date. But they are required to technically under the requirements, under their qualification and their membership with the different institutes. They would be more interested in perhaps some of the financial reporting webinars. They'd be interested in tax webinars as well, because they do have to fill in corporation tax returns, VAT returns, etc., but not so much the sort of personal tax planning webinars. So they'd look more at the corporation tax webinars, and they'd also be interested in probably some of the sort of payroll webinars, employment legislation webinars, those type of legislation or regulation changes that affect them in their industry. Most of them would be responsible for payroll, so payroll would be really important. And, you know, I think we all understand how important payroll is from any perspective, and it can go quite easily, it can go wrong quite easily. So that's really important as well.
Yeah, my aunt is retired now. She used to do payroll biweekly for 3,000 people. And I can think of absolutely no worse job in the world. But she's like a very calm person. Yes. You know, it's like you seem a very assuming type of person. And she did this job. And I was like, oh, are you mad? What are you doing? That seems like a potential for making 3,000 enemies every 2 weeks. Okay, great. So, Lindsay, thanks very much for coming on. Maybe you could tell us a bit about, like, how can people get in touch if they've listened to this here and they think they'd like to find out more about OmniPro or anything else you might be able to share to help?
Yeah, perfect. People can get in touch with me on LinkedIn. They can email me at lweb@omnipro.ie. I'm also going to send you a link, James, with a resource for anybody who is interested that will be pro forma sets of financial statements updated for the new changes to FRS 102. So there'll be a set for UK companies and for Irish companies. And people can always have a look at omnipro.ie if they're Irish accountants, or CPD Store, cpdstore.co.uk or cpdstore.ie if they're looking to get CPD webinars as well.
Very good. Oh, thank you very much. And thank you for listening this far. If you have, I don't like to let the listeners go away unrewarded for sticking with us. So if you're looking for some motivation, maybe as to why maybe you should consider start getting audited, I would recommend our newsletter. You're asking why? Well, every week in our newsletter, we have examples of financial mishaps that could have been avoided if an audit was done beforehand or maybe on a continuous basis. There's a range of different things. We have Naomi Campbell, for example, ended up in her newsletter because she didn't have sufficient oversight of her nonprofit that she had set up and the funds were being used inappropriately, all the way down to municipalities across the US who frequently find ways to mess up with taxpayer money and everything in between. So if for partly educational purposes, partly for the vicarious fun of figuring out how other people mess up their finances, you can sign up to our newsletter at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. I recommend it. And yeah, thank you. And thank you very much, Lindsay. It's been great finding out more about your services.
Thanks very much for having me, James. It's been great.